Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them.
Disrespect welcomes Ben Bishop and Bill Schmier, William Schmier, from Community Functionality Facilitation, and we're going to talk today about the AODA. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
January of this year, some of the customer service regulations were enforced.
Okay.
Some of the regulations have been enforced. Not all the regulations, some of the regulations.
That's just some.
All of the customer service regulations?
Well, the customer service regulations have for the public sector.
Okay, yeah.
All right, but the private sector ones still haven't. They come out next year.
Next year?
Yes. Well, 2012. They have 2 years grace from the government. So what we've been looking at with when the AODA was first conceived, the idea was to update the Ontarians with Disabilities Act, the original ODA, and that was created in 2001. So we managed to get a new act, basically an act completely updated from one to the other. Instead of its normal 25-year run, we had it done in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because the ODA was completely unserviceable, as far as because it only applied to the public sector, and there were so many exemptions with the ODA, it made it kind of useless.
Yeah.
So in comes the AODA in 2005, where Mr. Schmier and I, we both testified in all the committees for its passing. And we also worked with Minister Butriani at length for 3 or 4 months. Am I right on that one?
Yeah, about 3 or 4 months. We worked with her and other government officials just to develop the AODA Act, because with the ODA there was a few things that had to be changed, because there was a few words in there that had to be changed, like mites, and instead of mites they make it shalls,
okay,
and should, and yeah, so forth.
That's pretty good.
I like to, whenever we talk about the AODA, I'd love to talk about the just as a little sidebar there, I like to talk about the gentleman who really helped get the AODA passed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that was
that gentleman's name was
Jack Edwards. I think
yes, we were Jack about. Edwards. Yes.
Okay.
We have to really thank him for that.
Okay.
We had testified. We had testified just before this gentleman, and we were talking about how the idea of the AODA scared many people. We also talked about how there would be a lot of resistance. And we also said that there were difficulties with communication.
And this was pending implementation, right? You were bargaining, essentially, for implementation at this point.
That's correct. Now, the interesting thing that happened was we were talking about these communication problems and the resistance with the public sector and so forth. And the government officials at the time that were on the committees had stated that, oh no, we're beyond that. You know, we're in the 21st century. These things have been already addressed through education and so on and so forth. Well, up comes Mr. Jack Edwards, okay, and he comes up and he says, well, he says, first thing you're going to do with this new act is you're going to kill the economy. Those were the first words out of his mouth.
Oh,
and
yes,
the second words out of his mouth were, he said, the litigation is going to destroy everything. And he said, I have two books for the panel to read. He said, the litigation explosion and the case against lawyers. He said, He said that disabled people aren't such nice people either. And he said, and what's going to happen is a power monkey in a wheelchair is going to get a hold of a power monkey with a law degree and figure out how the whole thing works. Well, at that point, the panel had decided that we were right, that these people do exist, because one of them just happened to come up right
to
after
speak,
us.
Yeah.
Blown example.
And we spent about an hour trying to tell the panel that we did not pay the gentleman to come up after us.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. But yeah. Also the mob of people in wheelchairs just looking at this gentleman thinking, okay, let's go aside.
Yeah, and then you have us going...
Wheelchairs suck or anybody?
Yeah, that's about it. And then you have the rest of us sitting here just kind of laughing. You have Bill and I sitting here kind of laughing, going, you know, we couldn't have paid this guy to come up anymore.
So Jack Edwards, through no fault or virtue of his own, is largely responsible for the timely implementation of the AODA.
Because of that testimony, okay, we found out in June, uh-huh, on June 25th of that year, 2005, that the AODA passed in the legislature with one of the first times in history that a bill had passed unanimously in the legislature by all parties.
Oh, wow.
No abstentions. So it's actually even noted in the, it was actually even noted in the record for the day.
Okay.
Right. And it was interesting to
see the process.
Interesting. We weren't there, but it was interesting to get the call.
Yeah, they had called and asked us where we were for the party and so forth. They're celebrating, so.
Well, you know, they say about making laws and making sausage. If you like either one, you shouldn't be there when they're made.
That's true.
Yeah.
And the other thing, but, you know, then we go from this huge exuberant beginning to this unfortunate mid-ground. The AODA was passed with all the best of intentions.
All right.
The only problem is that good intentions tend to fall by the wayside with a number of different realities that people perceive as being a reason to change those good intentions. Where the AODA is concerned, it was supposed to be rolled out within a 25-year period.
Okay.
And we were actually one of the proponents of that, because changing policy is easy.
Yeah.
Changing attitudes is hard. Right, that's what takes the time, because you almost have to reboot people.
Yeah.
In Ontario, the feeling has always been that people with disabilities are dependents.
More or less, yeah, dependents. The people to be
overhead.
Overhead. I think that's a good way of putting it too.
And they feel that people with disabilities should be clients, not colleagues.
Okay.
So one of the biggest barriers to independence for people with disabilities still remains those people that are charged with trying to help them be independent.
Mm-hmm.
All right, because a lot of the times, like in school systems and so forth, they believe that accommodation equipment makes the student quote unquote different from the other classmates.
What makes them different?
Accommodation equipment.
Accommodations
and so forth. But the truth of the matter is that they are different.
Yeah.
And they shouldn't be worried about making them look different. What they should be worrying about is working on having people accept the differences.
Yeah.
I actually got a good example of that. We had a young child with a learning disability, and we had a spare computer that he could use as assistive device for school, right?
Right.
And so we gave it to the child to use in school and so forth. But because the staff didn't know how to use the computer, they took it and locked it up in a filing cabinet, and the child didn't get to use it.
Oh.
So right there, there's just...
So who was disabled in this scenario? The staff?
You're actually right.
Yeah.
The staff further disabled the student by not letting them use the equipment that they've been granted and that they require in order to keep up with the rest of their class.
Yeah.
So yeah, and what we're ending up with seeing more and more and more, where the AODA is concerned, is an unwillingness for the ministries to enforce their departments.
Okay.
The AODA right now, when it was rolled out, the idea was before the first regulations were to hit, Okay, and it's actually shown in the Act. There was supposed to be a tribunal set up, okay, by the AODA committee, okay, and there was which is supposed to be a separate body from everything else, and it was supposed to basically oversee the AODA issues. Now, that has never happened.
Okay.
So the regulations have been implemented, but there's no tribunal to enforce those regulations, which makes the regulations next to useless. The human rights has been dealing with some of these regulations.
Ontario Human Rights?
Ontario Human Rights, yes, but they haven't been able – but again, they have their own cases.
All right.
Right? So it makes them very reluctant to take on AODA cases because, you know, it just overloads them.
All right.
Right? And also – their primary task is to deal with the Human Rights Act, right, of Ontario, right, and you know that hamstrings them whenever they have to kind of pull double duty, And the other thing is that you have to show, in order to even bring it to Human Rights Tribunal, you have to show that there's an operational compatibility. Okay, between you have to show that it's a compatible, operationally compatible case. So that there's a human rights violation as well as an AODA violation.
Oh.
So you have to show the two.
Oh, okay.
So it has to be something that crosses for it to get into the Human Rights Tribunal.
Oh.
And there are a lot of AODA violations that are not necessarily in human rights, right? Because the AODA goes further. Mm. It goes further because it's group specific. It's like the difference between comparing a general practitioner. Between comparing two different types of doctors, like a general practitioner and a surgeon.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
A general practitioner, like the human rights, covers a number of different topics on a number of different areas with a number of different groups.
Yes.
Okay. Whereas the AODA is specific to disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there are violations of the AODA that just are not covered and are just too specific to be covered by human rights.
Okay.
Right, and rightly so, because that's not human rights. That's not human rights mandate, right? So, so what they did, what has happened now, basically, is the act is they've enacted the regulations, but they've hamstrung the ability to enforce those regulations.
Okay, we'll give you a chance here that you didn't anticipate, and make your best of it. I talked to you. Between interviews, and I asked who was the enemy. Was it Dalton McGuinty? And you said, well, no, he's actually quite a nice man. I'll pause for the audience to regain their composure because we've just had the budget come out. But who is responsible for this holdup?
The holdup for the AODA is the fact that the ministry responsible, and this is just our opinion, but the ministry responsible for enforcing the AODA is also the ministry that is most likely to be enforced by the AODA.
Community and social services.
Right. So now what you have, because it's in that ministry, you have an inherent conflict of interest.
Okay.
Because that's the reason why the AODA was put into the Ministry of Citizenship when it was first developed.
Okay.
Okay, because citizenship, although it doesn't have much experience with disabilities, still deals with matters of society.
Okay. You still say objective as
right? well, right? And it's also an objective ministry. Right? So why wouldn't the AODA be put in citizenship or in the Attorney General's, or Ministry of the Attorney General, like the Human Rights Act has been?
Yeah.
Right? Putting it into the ministry that is responsible, that it actually enforces, means that the people that this new tribunal will rule on are the same people that sign their paychecks.
Is this official?
It's in community and social services.
Oh, I see. So somebody was maybe doing a little blue sky thinking when they did that.
No, it's just another way of hamstringing the act.
Oh, okay.
Because how serious is a ministry going to be?
Right.
Okay, to enforce an act, okay, that they are
governed by.
Yeah, they're governed by, right?
Who would have the authority to assign the act to that ministry?
That's a very good question. Generally, the assignments for the ministries are done through the high bureaucratic staff.
Okay.
Okay. Political staff doesn't really assign them. What ends up happening is when the cabinet does an assignment, Okay, it's usually done by the government as a whole, by the ministers. So it's almost like a hot potato. You take this portfolio, you put this in your portfolio, I'll take this in my portfolio, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
So it's almost like a divvy up of tasks, okay, that's done with them. The AODA would not have been assigned by the premier.
Okay.
To this particular thing. I don't think that he would have wanted to deal with that. That no. would be more something that would have been done through the Minister of Citizenship and Community and Social Services, right, between those two ministries. I generally, I think that it was probably just assigned departmentally.
Okay. And no challenges have yet taken place to determine if it how applicable it is in civil court, unlike the Human Rights Act.
Generally, that's one of the biggest problems. Again, because there is no actual way of enforcing this. Okay, we have a number of cases that have come before civil court judges and superior court judges where the judges themselves have violated the act.
Oh, okay.
Okay, because they just don't know.
Right.
The training is deplorable.
Okay.
Okay, to say that...
We may have in 25 years, yeah.
No, I'm going to put out a really big word out here.
Yeah?
Incompetence.
Okay.
Incompetence is actually being very nice.
Okay.
Okay, and it's willful incompetence.
Right.
They've had this act since 2005, yeah. And yet almost every single lower government employee, okay, so the frontline employees, only maybe maybe out of all that, maybe only about 15% of them actually understand fully what the AODA is.
All right.
And very few of them understand that they're covered by it.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, you know, every time you bring it up to them, oh, I've never heard that, or that act is just for buildings, or that act is just for certain services.
Don't forget, what is that again?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Right? And so we deal with this all the time.
Okay.
And my challenge to Mr. McGinty is smarten up. You've passed your act. You've passed your regulations. Enforce the damn things. Because we're getting sick of cleaning up the mess. All right? Because what's going to end up happening is the act is on the books. Eventually, there will be a direct challenge. Okay, there have been a few in human rights that have cost the government dearly. Okay, there will be more.
Yeah.
And you can't change. And if you change the act, and those changes are challenged.
Yeah.
Okay, and it can be seen as a reprisal
for people thinking
as they have even more human rights problems on your plate that could cost not only the province a huge amount of money, but could also cost Mr. McGinty himself personally a lot of money.
Okay.
Because I'm just going to remind everybody, including all the politicians, that the AODA Act carries administrative penalties for the individuals,
okay,
as well as the organization.
Right.
And there is no specification that says the politicians are exempt.
Right.
So...
And any measure exempting politicians, as you just mentioned, could be viewed as a reprisal.
It would be not only as an reprisal, but could be viewed as prejudice.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. You know, this is a kind of we're all in it together act.
Okay.
Right. Everything was passed. You know, and to amend it now would send the message that disabilities really aren't important.
Right.
Okay, and by not enforcing it, that's what we're saying. We're not really serious about including the disabled. We're going to put all kinds of lip service to it, but we're not actually going to put real money to it.
Okay.
Right? And the government's using the excuse, like all governments do, that we don't have the money right now to do this. You know, we have a huge deficit, blah, 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 blah. Well, here's a question I have for the premier and for the politicians. What costs more money? Does it cost more money to exclude a population from society?
Yeah.
Okay. Or do you benefit more by including them? So does it cost you more to pay out all of their benefits,
okay,
for life and warehouse them? Or does it cost...
Tax-exempt benefits, I might add.
Right. Or does it cost you more money to do that? Or does it cost you more money to redevelop the system so it's truly a support system, so it allows people the opportunities to get educated properly, it gives them the full support to get educated properly, so they can have real job opportunities out there, okay? And there are penalties and systems in place, such as the AODA, that prevent discrimination by the employers, which gives the disabled a chance, a real chance at actually getting employed. So my question is, why isn't the government putting these resources into this population so that they can potentially get the tax benefit out of it? Would you rather them being dependent on you for disability
and not paying taxes?
Or would you rather them being independent and paying taxes?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. So I invite the government to do the math on it.
It seems they put some money into training in this
recession,
but it doesn't mean for disabled people.
Training doesn't mean a darn thing if the people that are doing the training don't want to get into those jobs.
Yeah. That's true.
If you really want to have training, you really want to have education, give them the choice.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give them choices you want to give them.
And now for a short break with Hamilton's Steve Strongman. That's me, honey. You've been listening to Ben Bishop and Bill Schmier of Community Functionality Facilitation talk about how the AODA came to be enacted and what supports exist for its enforcement and its implementation.
When it comes to disabilities, you need jobs that can accommodate the disabled. There are some low-skill jobs that can. Okay, there are some that do for certain disabilities, but for the majority, right, they need to have education so they get into skilled jobs, okay, not even just jobs but careers. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get the idea of jobs out. Let's get that off the table. Let's look at careers. Let's look at something lifelong. They need something that can do that, that can give them the, especially when we're dealing with people with schizophrenia, depression, and so forth, that need medication, people with certain physical disabilities that need meds and need assistive devices. We need something that gives them permanent benefits, gives them permanent drug coverage, and gives them permanent employment. Okay, because quite frankly, they don't want to be going from job to job to job to job to job.
Ben told me, Bill, that something like this is already in the works.
Okay, yeah, maybe Ben can comment more on that, actually.
Well, yeah, you know what he's talking about, the new transitional benefits and the new extended benefits from Ontario Disability.
Oh, okay. Transitioning over from ODSP over into the workplace. There is programs that can do it. There's two ways that you can do it. There's one way where you're almost leaving the ODSP program and then going into employment, and they give you a certain amount of money for employment costs to help you start up in your new career and so forth. And then there's another way where they still give you some of your ODSP, but cut it back because of the wages you're making.
Right.
So
I think key to this whole program is the welcome back feature, that you can go back onto ODSP if the employment initiative
falls short. That's a quick startup. That's a quick startup. Once you're on ODSP, if you get employed and suddenly it doesn't work out and employment stops, then they give you a quick re-up and you're almost immediately back.
It's called rapid reuptake.
And there's no time limit on that.
That is correct. I'm going to clarify a little bit about what Mr. Schmier just said.
Yeah.
Okay. There are two different benefits. There's transitional and there's extended benefits.
Okay. Okay?
Extended benefits, basically, you deduct 50% of your pay off of your paycheck, and it's routed to ODSP, mm-hmm. right? And then what happens is you get to keep your ODSP and the 50%, and then you keep your medical benefits and everything else. And that goes on until, let's say, they hire you on permanently.
Okay.
Okay? Then they put you on transition benefits, and if you have no drug coverage or anything like that, ODSP will keep your drug coverage until the private coverage kicks in. Okay, but you'll get no ODSP, any financial support from ODSP. It's just drug coverage.
All right.
Okay. Then you have transition benefits, which gives you drug coverage only.
Okay.
So people go right off that, and then they give you $500 for leaving the program.
Okay.
Kind of like a little, like, get you some extra clothes and stuff while you're transitioning and that sort of thing.
Yeah, okay.
So those are the two things that Mr. Schmier was actually talking about. The problem with both the problem with that, and the answer to your question, is that, yes, rapid reuptake works on extended benefits. Rapid reuptake also works with transitional benefits up to 6 months. Then after the 6 months, it takes up to 3 months to get back on ODSP. Okay.
You don't have to go the usual route.
No, you don't have to reapply. You wouldn't have to go through it all over again, but you just have to wait for processing. In other words, you're not put at the beginning of the pile. You're put like with you're put like with the new people.
What do you live on in the meantime?
Well, if you're leaving at that point in time, most places will give you severance, or you'll have the remainder of the. Or usually,
I think 12-week severance is a consequence of 12 years employment, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Right. So and again, there are also different circumstances too. It depends on what the individual's needs are, uh-huh. right? So, like, if the person got fired because of their being downsized or whatever,
right.
then ODSP would pretty much reuptake them.
Oh, okay.
Okay? But if they left, employment just because they felt like it, well, then no, then they have to wait. So it's dependent on every situation, and EI is no different either,
mm-hmm.
right? So in that sense, ODSP is becoming more like EI mm-hmm. for people who are leaving,
okay,
right? Who have gone off the program and coming back on.
So there are fewer pitfalls to going to work, but they're not gone.
They're not completely gone, but never will be in any program. The issue, though, is when it comes to employers, okay, and this is where, again, the AODA Act comes in, is they don't understand that just because somebody is on disability doesn't mean that they're just going to be able to snap right back on again, right? They think that, oh, well, you were on disability before, you can go back out, you can leave, you can go right back on disability. Well, they can go back on disability, but it's not necessarily quick snap right away, right? So that's got to, the employers have to keep that in mind when they're setting that up, because then that can be grounds for suit, okay, under the AODA if they compromise them in that way.
Okay.
What the big problem is right now with a lot of the services and a lot of the employers out there is they don't understand to what's out there for them to accommodate a person with a disability. There are tax credits, there are tax breaks, there are grants, there are a whole bunch of different things that can be given to these people. Even to get lodging for people with disabilities is very difficult who are on ODSP and such, because it's equated as welfare.
Well, right? there is a
or I should say Ontario Works.
There is an aspect of Ontario Works that favors their attainment of lodging, and that's that, I gather, on request, the landlord can ask for the rent to be paid to them up front, and the same is true for people on ODSP.
That's an occupancy agreement. That is correct. But a lot of landlords
don't... Is it voluntary?
Yes, but a lot of landlords do not know they can do that.
Well, can they do that, or do they have to have the consent of the...
They have to have the consent of the individual, but the fact that
if you're having difficulty staying housed, you'll give consent, probably.
Yes, but the fact they can do that... Okay, should be a plus, not a minus.
It is for many brighter landlords.
Right, because then they're guaranteed their rent.
Yeah.
But the problem is they see, again, people with disabilities as being a negative, not a positive.
Yeah.
Right, they see them as being, they again, it's equated with this, with people who are with a low income who are not disabled. I don't want to say second-class citizens, but it's very close. And they're not as seen as desirable as somebody who's making like $50,000 a year, who has two cars, kids, and the whole shooting match.
I've come to dread the question, are you on ODSP? Because landlords take a look at you and they gather that you're not unemployed because you seem to have stuff together. I mean, you don't look like someone who's unemployed. And they guess that you're on ODSP. And, you know, now you're into medical information. You know, I'm not sure I want to share this with you. And the only answer I've got for it is I don't think that I'm supposed to give you that answer. And then you laugh and you smile, you know, yeah. And they can make of it what they will.
Yeah, no, a lot of that stuff happens. And again, that's what the AODA was supposed to be brought in to prevent.
Yeah.
Right? The idea was that none of this matters, right? There are provisions in place for the disabled. They should be given the same opportunities in employment, housing, and everything else as everybody else.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is that we still have a long way to go.
Yeah.
Right? And
what's going to take us the distance?
What's going to take us the distance? There are a number of ways. There's really only one thing, and that's changes in attitudes.
Okay.
The only thing that works when you're dealing with people who are in power, there are three factors: power, prestige, and money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Unless the powers that be realize that by not accommodating a population that they will have all three of those factors interfered in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is the only way that they will actually make change.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there was enough of that for them to make the change with the AODA, but not enough to enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
So people have to show that it would be too costly not to enforce these regulations and too costly to exclude the disabled, right, in order for the politicians and bureaucratic staff, all right, to fully enforce this, to enforce these regulations.
Yeah.
I think it comes down to three words for it to be successful, which is education, enforcement, and communication. Mm-hmm. If these things aren't in place, the act is going to have trouble going forward and being successful, I think.
It's more or less a universal law. I remember driving a cab in another city where I told the supervisor, I said, I explained to the customer that it was dangerous to take the route that they insisted on, but they insisted upon taking it anyway. And then when we did, they complained it was more expensive. And the supervisor said, start with more expensive. You'll find they go along a lot easier. Huh. Yeah, and it works the same with government, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, but it is true, because the disabled are a tax base. They are a tax base. They're a potential tax base.
Yeah.
A potential source of revenue. And until they have their own economic stake, they're an untapped source of revenue.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, in order to be included, there are three ingredients you need in society, in order to be considered to be included in that society. One is an economic foundation, which the disabled do not have.
Right.
One is a political foundation, which they do have.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then one is a legislative foundation, which they do have. They have a legislative, social, and they have a political foundation. They do not have the economic.
Okay.
Without that pillar, okay, they're just going to keep toppling down.
So that's why we need the enforcement of the AODA.
The enforcement of the AODA allows for people to start considering, okay, that fourth pillar.
Okay.
It becomes the basis, saying that they have to build it.
All right. Well, I appreciate you saying that. Maybe this is a good time to ask if there was anything else that you wanted to talk about that we haven't covered in the interview, almost up to closing.
Well, I'd just like to just go back a little bit. I actually almost put out the challenge to the McGuinty government and people within it to start forcing in more on the AODA Act and starting to educate people and force it. And start including people with disabilities into the society more.
Okay.
And the one thing I just want to leave everyone in, stop. One thing we got to do is stop looking at the disabled as a disadvantage. Start looking at how to make it an advantage. And for the government, to stop looking at ways of getting around the disabled and start looking at ways of including them. Okay, so stop trying to look at ways of getting around the act that they passed and start trying to find ways of integrating it.
Very good. And maybe before we go, we should again thank David Blasek, the financial planner, who introduced us and enabled us to do these interviews for the show. Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Ben.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
And on this April 1st, it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. We remind you these are not the articles that we read from the newspaper. These are condensations of the articles. The full article you'll find in the papers that we quote in the broadcast. Globe and Mail, Tuesday, March the 23rd. This was a forecast for the 25th budget. The McGuinty government will promise to erase $24.7 billion deficit by fiscal 2018 in Thursday's budget, but will defer any big cuts to program spending until after next year's provincial election. April Fool. Finance Minister Dwight Duncan plans to unveil the 7-year time frame for balancing the books in the provincial budget, said sources close to the government, but the detailed blueprint for achieving that goal, including cuts to the $100 billion the government spends on health care and other programs, will not be part of the budget, sources said. In the last year's budget, Mr. Duncan said the province was facing 7 consecutive years of deficits, but the province's financial prospects have become much grimmer since then, when the deficit for the fiscal year ending March the 31st, 2010, was forecast to reach $14.1 billion. And the Hamilton Spectator, Wednesday, March the 31st. Carmela Fragamini, daycares, YMCA warn of higher costs. The Ontario government's proposed all-day kindergarten and after-school legislation allows only school boards to operate before and after-school programs for that age group, 4- and 5-year-olds. Many of those programs, as well as those for 6- to 12-year-olds, are currently offered by the YMCA and Today's Family. Jim Comerford, CEO of YMCA Hamilton Burlington Brantford, and Today's Child CEO Marnie Flaherty said they support full-day learning, but they feel making school boards run the before and after care for kindergartens means unnecessarily creating a new, more expensive system with higher
paid early childhood educators and new administration to replace one that already works with daycare-run programs. Daycares want more secure funding to cover the loss of 4 and 5 year olds whose fees covered some of the more expensive costs for toddler and infant care. Although the province has promised funding for this, we really don't know, said Flaherty. Parents of infants could face daycare cost increases of 30%, rising from an average $50 a day to $65, she said. And that's no April Fool. And from the Hamilton Spectator, Saturday, March the 20th, by Danielle Wong. Horvath wants answers on Siemens. MPP asks why local officials didn't know about province's talks with company to keep jobs. Ontario NDP leader Andrea Horvath plans to demand details of the province's failed proposal to keep 550 Siemens jobs in Hamilton. A lot of my focus will be on turning every stone that I can to make sure this doesn't happen again, Horvath, the Hamilton Centre MPP, said. Neil Everson, Hamilton's Director of Economic Development and Real Estate, would not comment on whether he thought the city should have been in the loop with the negotiations. Industry Minister Sandra Pupitello was unavailable. City Councillor Scott Duval said he was disappointed the city was kept in the dark. Councillor Bernie Morelli also said he was disappointed. From my perspective, the synergies were missed to maximize every possibility to keep them here. Siemens announced earlier this month it will move its manufacturing business to Charlotte, North Carolina in July 2011. The company was offered incentives worth millions of dollars from U.S. municipal, state, and federal stimulus grants and loans. That's not an April Fool either. From the Toronto Star, Monday, March the 29th, 2010, Star exclusive, welfare rules tweaked after diet allowance axed. Lori Monsabratin, social justice reporter. Ontario's social services minister is tweaking 4 welfare rules in the wake of outrage over the elimination of a special diet allowance in last Thursday's budget, the Star has learned. Anti-poverty activists last week rebuked the Liberal government, ending the program that provides up to $250 per month and helps 1 in 5 people on social assistance pay for extra food costs related to medical conditions such as diabetes and high blood pressure. Madeleine Meyer's advisory council on the government's promised social assistance review was particularly shaken by the move. We were disappointed they moved before we had an opportunity to submit our final report, said Advisory Council Chair Gail Nyberg of the Daily Bread Food Bank. People are in varying degrees of shock, but we are prepared to go forward, she said, of the council report that is due April 30th. In January, the council submitted the 13 most egregious welfare rules it thinks could be changed easily in advance of the larger review. But April Fool. Given Ontario's $21.3 billion deficit, Mayer said she could only move forward with 4 rule changes recommended that add little or no cost to the budget bottom line. The welfare rule changes expected to be finalized shortly. Shorten the welfare suspension period to 1 month from 3 months for a recipient who breaks a rule for the first time. Let people use financial windfalls like a lump sum child support payment to pay down a student loan or other government debt without losing eligibility for welfare. Change the shelter allowance calculation for people who share accommodation to reflect what they actually pay. Currently, those on Ontario's Disability Support Program can accept up to $6,000 annually in gifts, but able-bodied people on welfare are generally prohibited from accepting gifts, so some welfare workers deduct the value of a bag of groceries or money for a cab ride to a job interview from recipients' monthly checks. Mayer said the proposed changes will offer some direction so those on welfare can accept modest amounts of cash or goods. And from the Globe and Mail, taxation. Financial sector won't see GST hit, Ottawa says, by Tara Perkins, financial services reporter. Finance Minister Jim Flaherty has pledged to not impose any additional GST on financial services. suggesting that a rule change that appeared to cost the sector $1 billion was just badly worded. There is no intention of changing tax policy, he said at a press conference in Oshawa on another subject. Mr. Flaherty's comment was met with cautious optimism from the industry. Barry Siegel, a tax partner with Ogilvy Renault, said the comment should be viewed as a positive step in the tax and financial communities. April Fool, Mr. Flaherty's remarks suggested that the Canada Revenue Agency's February notice, which laid out what many experts in the financial sector viewed as a radical change to the way GST applied to a number of services, may have gone beyond what the Department of Finance intended, Mr. Siegel said. We will have to see whether the government's legislation conforms to Mr. Flaherty's comments, he added. And also from your federal government, federal tax dollars at work, Canadian Press. Gerges apologizes for letters from assistant. Embattled junior conservative cabinet minister Helena Gerges says she had no idea her office assistant has been sending pro-Gerges letters to local newspapers posing as a regular voter. Gerges, already under fire for an airport security tantrum last month in Charlottetown, says her riding assistant has agreed the letter campaign was inappropriate and has apologized. The assistant used her married name rather than the maiden name she uses in her professional life to send letters defending Gerges to newspapers in her Simcoe Gray riding northwest of Toronto, without any hint that they came from a Gerges employee. Liberal MP Wayne Easter notes that all cabinet members have a media clipping service that details every newspaper reference, so it's simply unfathomable that Gerges or her department didn't know about the letters. MP Easter calls it another embarrassment for the Harper government and says he can't understand why Gerges, the minister responsible for the status of women, remains in cabinet. Globe and Mail. Wednesday, March the 17th, I saved this one for you. Ottawa to continue internet access funding. Many organizations received a letter from Industry Canada dated March 9th advising that the community access program's budget would drop to $2 million annually and financing would halt immediately for 93% of CAP sites. However, after the letter became public, Mr. Clement told reporters that money would instead come from the government's broadband internet strategy, though this was not mentioned before. The federal government says it was all a misunderstanding. April Fool! The 16-year-old program sends about $4,000 each to libraries and centers that serve youth, seniors, and the unemployed, and many other sites so they can provide free computer and internet access to Canadians who need it. And concerning the soon-to-be staple of beat patrol and traffic cops, new rules to govern police taser use in Ontario. Globe and Mail, Wednesday, March the 31st. Romina Moreno, Toronto. Ontario promised tighter rules around the use of stun guns by police, including against pregnant women and children, but left it up to individual officers to decide when taser use is appropriate, a move critics said will do little to curtail abuses. There will be new guidelines regarding the, quote, vulnerable population, unquote, which includes the elderly, children, and pregnant women, but it will be left up to individual police officers to decide to use a taser. April Fool. Critics panned the changes as grossly inadequate in addressing concerns about taser use against youths and the mentally ill. Quote, there appears to be no real handle on when a taser is lethal as compared to being non-lethal, and we've witnessed some tragic deaths of people, said NDP Justice critic Peter Cormos. Ontario's review was launched after the 2007 death of Polish immigrant Robert Zakanski, which sparked a BC inquiry. And remember the story about the impoverished blind man who was prosecuted a few weeks ago for failing to stop his wife from killing herself. And we asked why prosecute a man who, as a free individual, in circumstances he found unbearable, entered into what appeared to have been a suicide pact. There appeared to be no evidence he induced a vulnerable partner to kill herself. They were roughly equal partners in their despair. Why was he held in jail for more than 2 months after being charged? Blind and poor, was he a danger to flee the jurisdiction? Of course not. He was a man with nowhere to go and no one to take him in. Was he a danger to society? Hardly. And why, after his 3 failed suicide attempts and after the death of the spouse, who he felt gave meaning to his life, did the justice system seek to punish him further? To deter other suicidal, abused, and impoverished people from entering suicide packs? Nonsense. This is not justice. This is the all-powerful state punishing the poor for having constrained choices. It is the state acting with neither humanity nor mercy. Well, the final April Fool, the Ministry of the Attorney General appears not to want to sentence him after all. And that's the news for Disrespect this April 1st. Come back next week, and there will be more. And to take us out, we've got a long cut this week. Jimmy Thackeray, Jimmy's Rude Mood. We'll be right back. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.